Up next, FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate talks with series host Carl Matzke. They discuss National Preparedness Month and the changing role of FEMA in preparing for and responding to disasters. From the Conversations Network's Social Innovation Channel.
Hi, I'm Chris Deigelmeyer, the Executive Director of the Center for Social Innovation at the Stanford Graduate School of Business.
And I'm Eric Nee, the Managing Editor of the Stanford Social Innovation Review.
Welcome to Social Innovation Conversations. Today, we're excited to introduce a new interview by Carl Matzke and our Disaster Relief Series, On Air, On the Ground, Leveraging the Private Sector's Expertise During a Disaster. Your host, Carl Matzke, is an experienced first responder and management consultant.
This series is brought to you by the Partnership for Disaster Response, an initiative of Business Roundtable to expand corporate commitment beyond financial contributions to enhance and accelerate on-the-ground relief and recovery following major disasters in the United States and abroad. The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free.
And now, here is Carl.
With September being National Preparedness Month, we have a special guest, FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate. Welcome to the program, Craig.
Thank you. You know, we look at this month of National Preparedness is based upon what the country went through in the aftermath of September 11th, what we saw with Katrina and other natural disasters, and the recognition that for businesses and the public, being prepared, not just looking at the federal government or what we call a government-centric approach to problem solving, is key to our ability to be resilient against a variety of threats, some of which are daily occurrences, it seems, with the weather of tornadoes and floods, as well as wildfires and other types of natural hazards, earthquakes and hurricanes, but also technological impacts, whether it be power outages or chemical spills, and the ongoing threat of the potential for terrorist acts against the United States, either our interest or here in the United States against ourselves. And so we talk about preparedness, particularly with the business community. I think it's important that I look at this as a bottom line issue, as the financial health of a business. The question I oftentimes ask people when we talk about business preparedness is, do you plan to be in business after the disaster? Because if you do, you got work to do. If you don't worry about it. Just assume you'll go out of business because you don't have a plan. And this is what I think is a bottom line issue. Not only do we need to look at the preparedness of a business to be able to operate after an event occurs, but also the recognition that if the public and governments are not prepared, it doesn't matter how good your plan is, you may not have the customers, the employees, or the services you need to do your job. So everything from getting schools open, which is usually the function of government, to people that have a place to live and can get back to work are all key ingredients to your individual plans. And having served at local and state, now at the federal level, I know the vulnerability, particularly in small to medium businesses who don't have the resources oftentimes major corporate companies do, and the fact that disasters unfortunately oftentimes result in their failure, that their ability to stay viable isn't there, and that by working as a team to prepare, we can reduce the impacts of businesses failing in the aftermath of disaster, but also recognize the business community brings goods and services that are needed every day in the community and more so during a disaster. So for us, preparedness is about building a better team. It's about recognizing the role that business plays every day in our communities, but also the recognition it is a business decision not to prepare. What that generally means is you're going to plan to be closed and not come back after a disaster. And that in itself is a decision. So we ask people to join us in preparedness. We think it's important to your bottom line. We think it's important to our communities. And we recognize and appreciate the value that the business community brings, both on a day-to-day basis, but also the unique capabilities they can bring when disaster strikes.
I've heard statistics that a large percentage of small businesses don't reopen after a disaster. Do you have any information on that?
I don't have the numbers, but my experience in Florida was we saw a disproportionate amount of small businesses fail. In some cases, they would immediately reopen in the disaster environment, but because of either the cost of operation, the lack of customers, or their inability to withstand the financial impacts, they still went under. And I think this is, again, a decision that we make as we go forward is there are some things that can help improve your chance of being able to survive the disaster and reopen and be viable as a business. And that could be anything from, you know, ideas such as business interruption insurance, or looking at, you know, in some cases, maybe not reopening immediately in the aftermath of disaster, but look for certain things to be established to ensure that you have a customer base or the services you need to be competitive and be able to operate profitably. And so, again, it comes back to doing a little bit of planning ahead of time, thinking through some of these options, and making a decision based upon what's going to be best for the business, but not going into it with the expectation that you can wing it, get by, or work real hard and you'll be successful. I've seen a lot of people put a lot of effort into trying to get back on their feet after disaster, and they still fail. And it generally is our smaller to medium-sized businesses that take the brunt of the closures.
It's certainly best to prepare in advance. Do you have any actionable advice you can give or resources someone could go to help get them prepared?
Sure. You know, one of the things we've recognized is for a lot of small business owners, time is an issue. And so if you went to our ready.gov site, we have a section in there for small, medium businesses with some toolkits to help walk you through the steps of what you could do to be better prepared. And again, I think it's oftentimes just thinking through some of this stuff and asking some, you know, very basic questions of, you know, I generally, you know, because we run the whole gauntlet, we say business, but I generally go, okay, I got a goods or service that I'm selling. I have a staff component, whether it's myself or employees, and I have to have customers, somebody willing to purchase that. And so when I look at my disaster preparedness and I look at the hazards in my communities, I need to look at all three of those, because any one of those that are disruptive could result in my failure. And if two or more are occurring, you know, it could be, you know, equally as, you know, much worse. So I look at things like, you know, what are my vulnerabilities to the goods and services? Is something I produce or something I depend upon suppliers to resell, you know, myself or my staff and my intellectual capital? You know, how is that impacted? What do I have to back that up? What are my resources there? You know, this comes back to if a key component of my business is my staff, then not only do I have to look at my business, I also have to encourage my staff to take the steps to be prepared so that they can come in and work after disaster. And then finally, you know, we tend to be very focused on our business, but we forget if the customers or the people that have that demand for our services also don't survive the disaster, are not able to come back because of the impacts of the community, it again means that we may still fail our plan. So I tend to start out with those three things and then go forward and look at, well, how can I reduce the impacts? What are the things I can do as far as planning? And again, these tool sets at ready.gov are really designed to help frame those questions for you.
Thank you for pointing the listeners to ready.gov. I visited the website, and you certainly have a good collection of tools there. I like the checklists that companies can use and individuals, frankly, for their own preparation. Let me change the direction a little bit here and reverse it to how can corporations and private sector organizations like the Partnership for Disaster Response be most helpful to FEMA?
One of the things that I've recognized over time is we've got to get emergency managers, and this is at all levels, to move from what I call a government-centric approach to problem solving and recognize that goods and services delivered by the private sector every day are oftentimes, you know, going to be attempting to get back up and operate in the post-disaster environment. And so sometimes for the emergency management population, I try to sensitize them to, instead of asking the private sector what you can do for us, is maybe a better question is, what can we do to get you open? And I think that's the kind of relationship we're trying to build. You know, if we have retailers that can provide, you know, groceries or hardware or pharmaceuticals into a community, oftentimes we will make the plans of how we would meet those needs and not actually reach out to the private sector and go, where are you at? Are you able to get open? And is there anything government could do to speed that process up? So, you know, when I meet with CEOs and I meet with folks, particularly in the large corporations, I really try to get across to, we need to work as a team, as a partner during a disaster to stabilize the environment. that the government can fill gaps but shouldn't be duplicating the inherent capabilities and flexibility that the private sector has in meeting these needs. And the other part of this is to drive home this point that they need to be a more active voice, particularly at the regional, state, and local levels, on the need to prepare communities and build the resiliency in against the hazards. Because I've seen this happen where we've had major retailers spend tremendous amounts of funds and resources to get stores open, only to have those stores either not meet expectation in sales or actually become a financial loss because the community that they were meant to serve never came back because that part, whether it was schools not getting open, homes not being rebuilt, affordable housing not being there. And so I think the particularly in some of the larger organizations, they can be a voice speaking back to locally and state elected officials that need to have strong programs at that level and to build that resiliency. Otherwise, again, one of the key ingredients that they need to be successful customers may not be there after the disaster.
So in addition to working with FEMA, the state and local governments you see as a real key to this resiliency?
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at most of the things that are going to have to take place, FEMA's role is really a support agency to the governors on behalf of the President, Secretary of Homeland Security. We coordinate across the federal family for assistance through the governor's request. But much of what will take place day to day and in the aftermath of a disaster and the recovery phase is really driven by the local response. And we've seen where, in some cases, strong relationships are there, great partnerships have occurred. In other cases, we've actually seen companies that are trying to do the right thing by installing generators and other, you know, things to get their stores where they can open quickly if there's a power outage, actually, you know, find themselves dealing with the, you know, permitting issues and zoning issues. And those are things that, although I'm sympathetic to, FEMA can't get directly involved, but those local officials and state officials can. And that's why I think it's important that we recognize that in dealing with this, although it may be convenient for people to see FEMA as a one-stop shop, we actually have to look at where our operation is going to be impacting the community and build those relationships. And sometimes it works out. You know, we may be working with the corporate office, the district and regional offices may be working with the governor's team, and the local stores and local distributors are working with their city and county officials in the areas they operate in.
That's an interesting response. So how has FEMA's role been changing in disasters over time?
Part of this is, you know, looking at the lessons of Hurricane Katrina and lessons from other disasters. Congress changed the law in 2006. It's the what they call the Post-Katrina Emergency Management Reform Act. And much of what's in there is actually clarifying and amplifying what FEMA's role is at the federal level, not just in running the reimbursement programs under the Stafford Act for governments and individuals, but in coordinating and at the federal level preparedness across all levels of government and incorporating in the private sector and voluntary organizations that can provide assistance in disaster. So, you know, part of what we've been doing since the Obama administration has come in is reach out to the business sector and start asking questions such as, if we're doing logistics, an example was with Hurricane Earl, which fortunately didn't make landfall or do much impacts, but with the potential there is reaching out with our logistics folks and conference calls through the associations and talking to many of the large-scale retailers and going, what does it look like to you guys? What impacts do you see? Are there areas of concerns that you may have about being able to get back into areas or stores that may be impacted that could disrupt the ability to provide commodities and goods so that we at FEMA can work with our state partners and better focus where we should be setting up, not to duplicate what the private sector is doing, but to address where potential shortfalls are and work more collaboratively as a team. And so I think as we continue to do that, that's going to strengthen that relationship. But it's changing this mindset that oftentimes when you give government a problem, we're going to look at it as how government would solve it. And I'm trying to get people to recognize that if we really want to incorporate and engage the private sector, the term private-public partnerships may not be sufficient. Maybe we need to be looking at this a little differently and recognize that the private sector is as much a responder to these disasters as government. And we shouldn't just rely upon what I call government-centric problem solving. Is I like to look around and go, well, who was doing this the day before the disaster? And that's probably the place to start. of how do we meet the needs versus just coming in and starting from scratch or trying to duplicate what oftentimes a private sector entity has already built a more robust system on a day-to-day basis.
So with that said, did you see any specific examples of things that were done differently in the preparation for Earl than, say, some of the previous hurricanes?
Yeah, it was, again, reaching out through the associations. We started the conversations. Fortunately, Earl didn't have the impact that it could have potentially had. But, again, just the fact that we were starting to reach out prior to landfall and to start this conversation, we've also taken an opportunity in several of our exercises to incorporate the private sector into that, particularly here in the capital region at the FEMA's National Response Coordination Center, of bringing in corporate leadership representatives for their emergency management operations. And so, again, this is really trying to move past the traditional, what I call, we go to an association, we say we need to work better together, and then that's it. We're actually trying to take and work at how do we bring the private sector in as part of this response. Where does it make sense to plug in? Is it a local or state, or what role we can have here at FEMA? And how do we provide the mechanism as we build this team that the private sector is an integral part of it, not some distant attachment or something that we will reference, but we don't really have the way to make it work in an operation.
One of the things we've seen is that technology is changing. The social networking certainly has changed the way people connect after disaster happens. How do you see technology revolutionizing emergency management?
Well, I'm not so sure. You know, people look at this and go, well, it's changing everything. And I'm going, in some ways, yes. In some ways, it's doing things a little bit differently. But I think probably the biggest change with the technology is this opportunity to have a two-way conversation with people in an impacted area that are able to provide real-time information about what's happening. And that means we have to change our thought process here. It may be a play on words, but it's I think it affects how we approach the challenge here. If we look at the public as victims and we look at the public as a liability we must take care of, we tend to discount their input and information during a disaster as not being an official source, not being verified, or being of questionable worth. But if you approach it from the standpoint that they're survivors, that the public's a resource, and they have capabilities, and that all of these phones and devices actually become sensors and data points that can help us build a better picture of what's going on and be more responsive to the needs, then I think there's some real opportunity here. This isn't to be confused with, you know, we're not going to be able to have a one-on-one conversation with everybody in a disaster area, nor, you know, at our level would we be necessarily the best place for people to get the information about locally occurring impacts. But as we've seen most recently with the current fire in Boulder and the canyons, people being able to send up pictures from their Flickr accounts, tweeting out from that, pasting updates on their Facebook, is actually providing a lot more contextual information of the severity of impacts versus somewhat the sterile situation reports that may be issued by various agencies. And so that ability to get information rapidly from a scene to observe how response is occurring in the eyes of the people we're trying to serve and to have them provide us information about what's going on in an area, I think is a next big leap for us. But it has a lot of challenges and a lot of what I would call built-in bias against taking this information and acting upon it, because I hear this, well, it's not official, it hasn't been validated. The problem with that is oftentimes by the time it's official or validated, it's outdated. And so it's a conversation as we continue to have, and we see more and more examples of how people are sharing information, looking at how we incorporate that and to do a better job of responding to the survivors.
That's very interesting. When I was working down at the Hurricane Ike shelters, we were able to access information from the local power utility. So even from 100 miles away, we could tell which homes had power and which ones didn't. It really provided a calming factor, certainly for the residents of the shelters, to have that greater flow of information.
You know, again, as you point out in Florida, some of the hurricanes, and we saw this in Katrina as well, where one or two individuals were able to get back into neighborhoods that were hit and began sending out essentially reports to everybody in the neighborhood by posting updates on Facebook and taking pictures with their phone and updating it and people oftentimes getting the first sense of what this meant to their homes and their neighborhood. And for a lot of folks, it was one great news because they could see their house looked pretty good. In other cases, they could see that they probably lost everything. But we saw that people were sharing information, knew that their neighbors were desperate for information. And again, this wasn't an official government source, but it was a neighbor that was just trying to help everybody else find out what had happened in their community.
Right. Well, sometimes the news isn't always correct, but somehow it seems having news is better than no news in this case. The last item I wanted to talk about before we close the interview is if you could ask the business community to come together around a topic or initiative to support FEMA and its mission, what would it be?
I think it's to recognize that if local government, and again, this is, you know, we can do a lot of stuff here at the federal level, but really it's the local level where this really pays off, is not be passive. If your community doesn't get it, if they're not taking the steps to prepare for the hazards, they don't have exercise programs that incorporate the private sector, then I think the private sector needs to understand this is also a financial impact to them. The communities that aren't prepared are going to cost them money in trying to get back on their feet. And as much as we use our bully pulpit to talk about preparedness and encourage and try to get communities to improve their preparedness plans and incorporate the private sector, I think the private sector, particularly some of the industry leaders, need to be clear to local officials that when we build or come into your community or have businesses there, we have expectations that we will be incorporated into the plans and that we will be part of the team. And I think, you know, there's some work we need to do, but I, you know, if the private sector is advocate for preparedness in general, recognize that this is a significant impact to all of us, but also it's a bottom line issue. If the customers aren't there after the disaster, you may not succeed. If the community fails in providing basic services after the disaster, you may fail. You know, if you don't have the resources or you haven't planned ahead, you may fail. All of these could be indicators for you going out of business. And for local governments, we know that that is oftentimes the second impact of a disaster. Not only do you deal with the disaster itself, the small businesses that fail, the medium businesses that fail, the large corporations that don't come back, they lose jobs, they lose tax base, and the ability to provide services for the future. So I think business communities need to understand that they got everything at stake here as to the performance of the citizens and the government institutions, and that they can use their bully pulpit to continue to push the message of preparedness both for themselves, but also for their customers and staffs.
Ed Minister Fugate, thank you for sharing your time with our listeners. I appreciate your participation.
Well, thank you.
You've been listening to an interview by Carl Matzke in our disaster relief series, On Air, On the Ground, Leveraging the Private Sector's Expertise During a Disaster. For more provocative ideas, check out the award-winning Stanford Social Innovation Review at ssireview.org.
Your host, Carl Matzke, is an experienced first responder and management consultant.
This series is brought to you by the Partnership for Disaster Response, an initiative of Business Roundtable to expand corporate commitment beyond financial contributions, to enhance and accelerate on-the-ground relief and recovery following major disasters in the United States and abroad. The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was Paul Figiani. Our website editor was Cindy Yee. The series producer is Bernadette Clavier.
This is Chris Deigelmeyer
and Eric Nee on Social Innovation Conversations.
Thank you for listening.